This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
It's Friday. It's midday. It's noon. Just gone noon. It's 15 seconds past noon, and you are listening to Five Star Fan Club with me, your host, and
your host and compound,
and your other host, Nathaniel
Metcalf.
Metcalf, yeah.
That's right. Yeah,
I, of course, need no introduction. My name is. First rule of Fan Club is tell your friends about Fan Club.
Second rule.
Tell your friends about Fan Club.
For the love.
For the love of God.
For the love of Mary.
If you told your friends about Fan Club, if you told one friend about Fan Club, you would have one less friend.
But who needs them?
Who needs
They're the friends you don't need.
Who needs friends anyway? All you need is... connection to broadband and some sort of computer or a phone. I think you can listen to it on your phone now, can you?
Oof. Yes.
Yeah, you can.
Get the times. That gadget is, show. It's like the gadget show.
That is fucked up beyond all recognition. Am I right? I'm having a good day.
We're having a nice day. We've already started.
I think there's always like a little bit of tension just before we go live. And we are live this week.
Oh, yeah.
But just before we go live, where it's all kind of like very much like... Natalie's telling us what to do, and she's making sure that we don't mess around. And she goes, make sure that you mention this, and make sure that you do that. And we're like, yeah, sure. And it's very tense. And as soon as we go live, we just realise there's not a thing she can do about it.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like we're like Private Parts.
What's we're like Howard Stern.
Howard Stern. We're like him, aren't we?
Yeah, but we're not so stern, are we? We're more like Howard Silly. Oh my God! I wish I were dead. So here we are. We're back again. Another week has passed, and we find ourselves in the icy morn and chilly atmosphere of Friday in May. I wasn't expecting to be so cold this morning. That were you?
I'm warm in here.
See, my new window, it overlooks the sun. Or the sun, rather, shines in. Well, certain as the sun rises in the... My window is easterly.
Easterly.
That's how I remember the lyrics to Beauty and the Beast as sung by Angela Lansbury. Star of Murder, she wrote. And others. And... So the sun, my window is easterly. And yesterday, I woke up absolutely drenched in sweat. Not mine. And I was bathing in sunlight. Forgotten to draw the curtains again. I thought, bloody hell, have I left the central heating on? And do you know what? No, I hadn't. It was just warm. Today, I woke up and I was freezing in bed. And I'd had a very long day. Started a new eating plan, 1,600 calories a day. That's not a lot, Nat.
No, what?
The average man needs about 2,000. I'm 400 shy.
But like, what counts as 1,600? Is it that thing where you eat a spinach and you're done?
You basically have to breathe a bit less. You eat a spinach and you're done. No, actually. I had three meals yesterday.
It worked for Popeye, though.
It did. I mean, exactly. He was stronger than any man I've ever seen. So today I woke up, it was very cold. I was very tired last night. I did a full day's worth of worrying. And then I did a gig. And first 20 back in a year and a bit. And bloody hell. Bloody hell. The last 20 I did was at Christmas 2017. I think it was 2017. What year are we in now? Yeah, 2017, Christmas.
Not your own gig, though.
No, Shepherd's Bush. I did Fuckfest on the Monday, I did Shepherd's Bush on the Wednesday, and then I did a music gig in Stroud on the Thursday. Friday was Christmas Eve, I think, and then it was, or the day before Christmas Eve, and then maybe Christmas was on the Saturday or the Sunday. So it's like it was an absolute clusterfuck of a week leading up to Christmas. And I thought, do you know what? I'm not going to do this anymore. And I didn't. And then yesterday was my first one back, and I got out my little notebook. It was all Christmas material. What am I going to do? I didn't do it. I just had to think on my feet, and that is the very nature of stand-up. Although most of the thinking in stand-up is done at home, and you're just regurgitating stuff from earlier. Anyway, I went to bed. I fell asleep, zonked out in front of the TV, watching Dinner Impossible.
Don't know, Dinner Impossible.
Can you look up Dinner Impossible? I can't remember. His name is Chef something. He's like a bodybuilder. He's like a northern bodybuilder. He's
so
got
it's a British
huge
show?
Arm. No, it's an American show. He's got huge arms, tiny head.
So when you say northern, but British northern host.
British northern host. He's over in America. He's been doing Dinner Impossible for a long time. What used to happen was, anyway, long story short, but look it up because we can talk about this. But look at, I fell asleep watching that, and I woke up in the morning and I was absolutely freezing. I jumped out of bed, and because I was so tired, I'd gone to sleep with my socks on. And even with my socks on, it was cold. So if you're having trouble starting your car up this morning and scraping ice off the windshield, then do write in and let us know. You're listening
send
to
us
five,
photographs. If you've got snow, send us photographs of some snow.
You're listening to Five Star Fan Club. and if you're out there listening, keep warm. Now
they do that on the news now, don't they? They say in the news, like when it's snow day, they go, send us in pictures of some snow. And it's like, everyone can see snow. This isn't news. Dinner Impossible with... Oh, God, I wasn't expecting that face.
Yeah. Chef Robert Irvine.
He looks like a Nazi from an Indiana Jones film.
Oh, well. So, we'll tell you what he does look like. He looks like the big Russian from the fourth one, Crystal
right,
Skull.
Yes, yes, yes.
But he's like, he's got huge arms, right? And now I probably used to watch Dinner Impossible, I would say 10 years ago. And what it used to be.
It's been going 10 years.
Well, just hear me out. Prepare to learn something without talking all over it, Nathan.
Okay.
I forgot what I was saying now. No, I haven't. So. Has it been going 10 years?
Didn't you say you watched it 10 years ago?
I think I watched it 10 years ago. Can you give us some more information there, Natalie? Natalie's not a real person. It's our in-house computer.
So it's our AI. Like,
I? That's what I thought the Steven Spielberg film was called. It's just at the time of the Allergy Show.
Yeah, makes sense. Cashing in.
Not bloody hell.
Sometimes Stanley, he follows, doesn't he? He doesn't always lead.
Stanley Kubrick had his finger on the pulse, didn't he? Before it ended. So I was watching it 10 years ago, and the one episode that I do remember was what they used to do is they used to put him in a location, and it would often be in the middle of a field with no electricity and no supplies and nothing, and he'd have like a small but he'd say, right, what have you got to cook with? We've got a pan, we've got a spoon. Right, I'm going to need more. I'm going to need burners. I'm going to need a tent. I'm going to need some cafeteria space. You know, and he'd sort of like have this big list, and he'd basically have to cook. He'd have to cater for an event with like no supplies, and then he'd have to get it all together.
Yeah, but that's not impossible.
And then someone would come in and say, I'm donating a large tin of tomatoes. And he'd go, that'll do. Right, what am I going to make with the tomatoes? And it'd be all like, you know, documentary style. And it would be like, I just remember one episode where he had to make like a healthy meal for a group of kids. Yeah. You've gone very quiet. I was only joking that you weren't allowed to talk.
No. I was just trying to take it all in. Because it already feels like, if he's like said, he's in the middle of a field and they go, right, you've just got to do a thing with everything that's just in this field. He goes, right. He comes out and goes, get me an oven. It's like, well, you've already failed.
No, that's not the thing. Get me Tuvan. I mean, are you saying that January 24th, 2007 to July 7th, 2010 was when Dinner Impossible was on? That was it?
Yeah.
Okay, because he's got a new series. Can you just look up what his new series... Can you just get Robert Irvine up, please?
So it's a new series. It's a Dinner Impossible 2.
I thought it was
D-I-I-I.
I thought it was... this one's directed by John Woo.
Wow.
Woo.
Get me doven. Get me them doves.
I'm baking doves.
it's a niche. It's good. It's
very niche. Robert Paul Irvine is an English celebrity chef and talk show host who has appeared and hosted a variety of Food Network programs, including Dinner Impossible, Worst Cooks in America, Restaurant Impossible. That's what I'm watching at the moment.
Restaurant Impossible.
So Dinner Impossible was a show where he'd have to do these things.
He's got one called Chopped Impossible.
Hero Welcome, Operation Restaurant, All Star Academy, Guys Grocery Games, Chopped Impossible.
I've got to chop this. I've got to chop this tomato, but all I've been given is hammer.
I've got to chop this car with a blunt knife. That's impossible. That's impossible. I've got to chop this house in half with a celery stick. It's not bloody happening.
I've got to chop a chop with another chop.
Ooh. Called Chop Chop Chop.
Got a chop a chop with a chopper chop.
Incredible. So
impossible.
You want me to chop what with what? Impossible.
The end of the show. Credits. It is impossible.
It was good. It was more of a little stinger in between other shows. So he comes in and he did this thing. I just remember the one episode of Dinner Impossible that I remember watching. He had to do it. Don't get rid of it. Don't get rid of it. We're still using it. Right, but that is a picture of him. I mean...
Is that real?
Yeah, he's a bodybuilder, basically. He's this chef. Anyway, he had to cook
that. He's got a tiny head.
He's got. That's what I said. He's got huge arms and a tiny head.
Checks out.
He had to cook this... cater an event for these kids, and it was healthy eating, so he did loads of vegetables. And one of the things that he did was he boiled some julienne carrots, mm-hmm. Which are like sort of like matchstick carrots. He boiled them in 7-Up just to make them more interesting for the kids.
It's not healthy though, is it?
You've taken something that's natural, that is naturally sweet, delicious, good for you, and you've bathed it in 7-Up. I mean, it's like you fucking... I mean, it was moronic, but I do like
him. Got some carrots and covered them in pop.
I do like... If we can get him on, that would be great. If we can get him on the show. Anyway, he's got a new show called Restaurant Impossible that I've started watching, and basically the format is... Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares. It's the exact same show.
Now we're talking. I love Kitchen Nightmares.
You've got a British chef that goes into an American restaurant and he goes in and he has a massive go. The only thing is they've changed slight bits where he doesn't swear as much. Like, he's not just using it as a gimmick. You get the feeling that when he swears, he's actually really genuinely upset. He throws in a bit of counselling here and there, where he counts, there's always someone that's being abused by, mentally abused by their staff or their parents that own the restaurant or something like that. So he gives them a bit of counselling, and he's sort of like very supportive of them. And then also he checks in every so often, and rather than it being kind of like, whereas they do a makeover overnight on Nightmares.
Yeah, yeah. Where I love it.
You just think, how do they... It's like Challenge Annika. It's like they leave one night in a shithole, and in the morning, it's a shithole with some paint on it.
But it must be, because you've only had 12 hours. It must be like wet paint. You must be going in there going, I can smell fumes, paint fumes, and like...
It's like when I looked around my house, when I was looking for a flat. I looked around a flat, and I go, oh, this place is beautiful. Oh, my God, it's absolutely gorgeous. And then you buy it and you move in and you're like, oh, my God, none of the finishing is done. Like, the floorboards are coming up. Like, everything is kind of superficial that it looks like they've given it a wipe over, right? But basically, it's all superficial stuff. And the minute you start actually using it practically on a daily basis, everything just starts falling apart. But what they do is they start the process at the same time that he's going in. So they're renovating the place, and he goes and he checks up on it. And, but apart from that, it's the exact... I was kind of like... I thought basically... I didn't realise that they'd changed the name from Dinner Impossible to Restaurant Impossible. But I thought basically they'd just sort of like tried to get away with it. No, we've always been doing this. We've always been doing this.
Like,
no, you used to be boiling vegetables in 7-Up and feeding it to obese children. It was, of course, that was back then in 2007 when... Obesity was more of an issue. Of course, it's not.
The bit in Kitchen Nightmares that always gets me is the bit where he goes into the restaurant and he walks into the kitchen and he goes, right, put all your stuff down, everyone has to stop cooking.
What, in
Kitchen Nightmares?
Yeah.
Ramsay comes in and they go, oh, it's Chef Ramsay, as they call him. And they all sort of go, oh, God, he's here. And he goes, yeah, put it down. And then he does that thing. He walks out into, like, the restaurant proper. And he goes, right, sorry about this, everyone. You're all going to have to leave. And I always just think, why don't you just go, no? I mean, I'm having my dinner. Like, as much as it might be like, oh, you could cook this at home. This is horrible. This is horrible restaurant food. There's people in there. Some of them are probably just eating it, like, just having the dinner. It's like, yeah, you got to leave now. Just be like, no. I'm going to finish my dinner,
he
please.
He normally asks people to leave when they've found a rat has shat out a cockroach.
I'm having my dinner.
Oh, fucking hell. A rat's just shat out a cockroach in the souffle. Sorry, guys, you're all going to have to leave. A rat's just shat out a cockroach in the souffle. You're eating the souffle, mate. Get the fuck out of here. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Now, I have seen some kitchens in some states, but this
he's always surprised, isn't he?
Always,
always surprised every
always
week.
Always using his hands in gestures that don't correspond with what he's saying.
Yeah.
And then he always mutters something when he's walking off.
Yeah. And at the end,
pumpkin hummus, unbelievable.
At the end, he's that thing where he does it and he's like, he's not in touch with his emotions. So it'll be at the end where someone will go, oh, I've really saved my family, Chef Ramsay. And someone will like hug him or something. And he's like, thanks, darling. Thanks. And he'll sort of like tap her or something and she's trying to hug him. He's like, thanks, darling. And then he walks off. He puts his coat on, his big coat, and he walks off as if he's like walking to the next town. It's like the end of the Incredible Hulk every week. He's sort of like, where's he going? It's like, my job's done here. My existence now is to save restaurants. I'll walk on to the next town and I'll, you know, maybe get on like a hay bale sit on a train, run along a train track.
Can you get a list of Gordon Ramsay's shows up? There was one show that he did. It was a British show that he did. So I've got a point about this. It is like that. I mean, it is just, but the British version is better. The American version is kind of like they tell you what you're about to see. They show you and then they tell you that you've just seen it. Mm. And it's like that. And it's just kind of like you watch the same content 3 or 4 times throughout the show, and then they do like a recap at the beginning of the next half, then do a recap at the end of the episode, and you sort of, there's probably about 10 minutes of footage, and then they just basically get like 22 minutes out of it. There was one episode of, and I did like a routine about this on Heavy Entertainment, but we had to cut the point of the routine, so we did sort of like the setup, and the punchline was like this other thing. So Gordon Ramsay did this. Gordon Ramsay did this show that was on in the daytimes. Was it Ultimate Cookery Course? It was something like Gordon Ramsay's
Cook Along Live.
No, it was something where he was like cooking. Maybe it's the Ultimate Cookery Course. Yeah, that's about right. 2012, and they used to repeat it on in the day. These aren't all of his shows, though, are they? It finishes in 2013, and then what? He just stopped working, did he? Bloody hell.
Nice for some. He just does it. He does the same thing, but not on telly anymore. Just travels from town to town.
He did a really good episode. There's a hot wing show on YouTube where they all eat hot wings, and that's quite good. And Gordon, well, it's not good, but Gordon Ramsay was on it, and he had a good episode.
He did that one recently where it was him, Gino DeCampo, and someone, and Fred from First Dates.
It's like The Expendables.
it was one of those things where you go, God, Gino DeCampo seems like an absolute nightmare. And you'd almost like, you just think, oh, like, get rid of him. Like, it feels like if you were one, like the other two are just, you sort of see him, he's like sort of being like a jolly prick. Like, do you know what I mean? He's like, kind of like, oh, Christ. Just like awful. And the other two, it's like you think, Fred from First Dates just seems like a really nice bloke who's just like, just wants to get on with his life.
Who's Fred from First Dates?
You know, he runs the restaurant, the French.
I mean, you say that, but I don't. Yeah, right. So
you've seen First Dates, have you?
I've seen bits of it in passing. Is he the guy with the beard?
Yes.
Right.
I love First Dates. Absolutely love it. But yeah, Fred, he's like, and he seems like he's Like, I was a bit suspicious of Fred, to be honest, on first dates. I thought he was a little bit creepy. Now I think he's all right. I think he's a good guy. But, like, Gino De Campo, absolutely awful human being. You just go, what is wrong with you? He's like, Gino De Campo just feels like, what's he trying to get away with? It feels like the stories. It feels like there's definitely, there's, like, allusions to, like, skeletons in his cupboard that you're like, what have you done? And the other two are just like Gordon Ramsay's, like, quite a hard person to kind of get on with. But in that company, you go, I mean, Ramsay seems great.
Ramsay's sailing out of this. Yeah.
He comes across so well by comparison.
I love TV chefs. I love food shows. I love Chef Robert Irvine. I think he's great. And the thing is, he's so... I don't know. He's not a name over here. So he's I don't know how big he is in America, but he's obviously got a career out of it, and he's got a restaurant in Las Vegas. And I just find the fact that he pops up at late night TV, kind of like, and over the years you've sort of grown with him. and when he kind of like sits down and he like talks to a guy about the fact that his parents are overbearing and he needs to sort of like break it, it's kind of like you go, oh God, he's got a heart as well, you know. I'm fascinated by them.
Like, well, they kind of make too much of that on the Ramsay ones, which, and it always seems out of character. Like in the American shows, he seems much more caring.
Because it's all theatre.
Yeah.
Like, Gordon Ramsay doesn't really swear that much, and he's not really that angry, and, you know, and it's TV, isn't it? And that's what it is. It's just all, it's, you know, he's playing a character. He's selling a brand. Gordon Ramsay, you know, has quiet moments where he's quite introspective, I imagine. And then, you know, but that's not what they're selling. In England, he's exaggerated. In America, he's a cartoon character. Mm. And you just like go, yeah, fine, fair enough. But the point is, like, so he went into this place and it was like this little, I think it was like a Greek restaurant. In America, I can't remember where it was.
Is this Irving or
no? This Ramsay? Is Ramsay, and this is ages and ages ago. And there was this guy, and he was making pumpkin hummus, right? And Gordon Ramsay ordered it off the menu, and he ate it and tasted it, and he said, "This tastes like snot. This is disgusting."
Did he say snot?
He said snot, right? And he said, this is, like, it was revolting, right? The way he described it was revolting, right? He said, this pumpkin hummus, what were you thinking? What were you fucking thinking? You know, he does the whole thing, tricks him into a false sense of security. And the guy goes, oh, yeah, it's just this thing that I invented. I thought, why not make hummus out of pumpkin? You know, it was Halloween. You know, there was some story behind it. It was Halloween. We had some leftover pumpkins. I made some pumpkin hummus. And Gordon Ramsay eats it. And he goes, oh, it's watery. It tastes like snot. He has this massive go at him. He goes, get it off the menu. Right? Rather than being constructive and going, I see what you're trying to do. And that's what I find the problem with all of that show, is that he's not helping them with their business so it's sustainable. He's not like going, right, your lasagna recipe is fucking disgusting, but if it's lasagna you want to make, why don't you try making it like this? He goes in and says, what you need to do is make you're a Turkish seafood restaurant. What you need is you need an all-American bar and grill. And then he'll close it down. And then they'll be like, and then they'll start doing this thing. And it's not what they wanted to open in the first place. It's like they've inherited someone else's idea of what, and it's basically designed just to be a moneymaker as opposed to something that's a passion project for them. It's kind of like, right, well, the passion now is that we're going to make loads of money. But it's not something where they can kind of, I don't feel like, and you hear that a lot of these restaurants shut down, and I think it's because they're not sustainable in terms of, that's not what their dream was. So I think that he'd be much better off going, I can see what you're trying to do with this pumpkin hummus, it's absolutely fucking disgusting, but why don't you try doing it like this, and it will cut down the moisture of it, and if you season it like that, you know what I mean, giving him some tips so that he can actually be proud of something. Instead, what he did was, you know, they opened up a bar and grill and then they closed down within however many months, and he walks off into the sunset and he's literally wagging his finger going, pumpkin hummus, unbelievable, right? And the pumpkin hummus thing was in part one, and then he hated it so much that in part two he's wagging his finger going, pumpkin hummus, unbelievable. My point is that was Kitchen Nightmares USA. Then, 2 years later, he did. Where's it gone? Oh.
Why are you deleting stuff that's in front of us? 2 years later, he did this. Oh, fucking hell.
He did what? Home cooking?
He did Gordon Ramsay's Ultimate Cookery Course. And one of the recipes, it's 100 meals that you should learn to cook.
Right, like
that,
basics.
That he's created. And one of the things on it was butternut squash hummus. And you go, a butternut squash is the same as a fucking pumpkin. It's just shaped differently, mate. And it's like, so he's basically gone over to this guy, called him a cunt in front of his kids, spanked his ass on live TV, on American national TV, told him he's a cunt for having dreams, made him change his whole fucking ethos, shut down his business, opened up a bar and grill, went bust. And then 2 years later, he's like, going to tell you what, I've just invented this great new dish. It's called butternut squash hummus. You can look it up. It's in, like, I did this material. David Trent bought me the actual cookbook that it came in. He's just like, go, I could, when he did it, I was like, I was absolutely like flabbergasted. Just like, go, that is one of the most fucking, and it's bald, like, the evidence is in front of you, you know. And maybe he did have this recipe for butternut squash hummus and he's always had it in his back pocket and thought, I'm going to do this one day. But the guy still invented pumpkin hummus, and he still went over and he shut him down. Mm. And he said, you know, whether he invented it beforehand or he stole the idea, it's just kind of like, it's there on TV. Yeah. One of them's an American show and one of them's an English show. And it's just kind of like, you go, fucking, it's in his fucking cookbook.
Because also it seems like, as a concept, it doesn't sound that bad. Pumpkin, but like a pumpkin.
Well, you just think, if he's got the consistency wrong, just tell him... Yeah. Oh, you're doing it wrong. And I think that goes for all of the restaurants. You just go, you're doing it wrong. Like, I see what you're trying to do, but you're doing it wrong. He just goes, no. And this is what it's going to look like. You're going to take down all your family photos. We've taken down all your family photos and burned
Where
them.
Where are they now? Oh, I don't know. Honest kid.
And there's a shot of a rat shitting a cockroach on Grandmama. And it's just like, yeah, fucking... I really love all of those shows, though. I love Gordon Ramsay, and I love the Hairy Bikers, and I love... You know, I like watching them, because I find them all fascinating, you know. But I do find it fascinating.
Do you like them as personalities as well? So, do you remember... we talked about the other fella, Irvin... He was
Robert Irvin.
Do you remember the guy who Brian Turner, who used to be on This Morning?
Yeah.
And his thing was always like, "Yep, now I'm going to cook some roast beef, and you can't get that in London, can you?" You can. You don't get that in London. It was always about like how everything in Yorkshire was like. You got a bit of steak and ale pie. I bet you've never seen one of them in London. And it's like, yeah, we've got all that stuff as well. It's like, you never will have seen it. It's just like, it was like an advocate for Yorkshire about everything, all the food that he made was stuff that you've never seen in London.
Whenever he did Ready, Steady, Cook, he'd always be aggressively competitive. You know, it was jovial, but underneath the surface, it was just that he would take it a bit too far, and it would just be kind of like, you know, there'd be a hint of angry bitterness coming through, and there'd always be like a glint of northern misogyny coming through. It's like Brian Turner, and but he's been around for ages, and now you watch, and he's great. I think that he's, you know. I think when he was in that competitive... I mean, I just think that they're people that become wallpaper and they're just always there and you grow fond of them. And I love Brian Turner. I think he's all right. My favourite all-time show is Great British Menu. And I think that is...
Who hosts that?
I don't think it's got a host.
Oh.
It's basically, it used to be, I think Jenny Bond used to host it in the kitchen and interview people, like in the early days. And then she became a voiceover. And now there's sort of like a Jenny Bond sound-alike that does it. But basically, Prue Leith used to be on it.
Okay.
And she was the judge that used to come in on the Friday. So you used to have starter on a Monday, fish course on a Tuesday, main course on a Wednesday, dessert on a Friday, and then you'd have all four, and then there'd be three judges, and it'd be regional. So it'd go on for like 10 weeks, and there'd be three chefs who would have a celebrity chef or a previous winner come in and oversee it. Like Marcus Waring would kind of oversee it. And then on the Friday, and he would give them points out of 10. They'd tot it all up on Thursday. Then two of them would go through to the final round, go head to head in front of a panel of judges with Matthew Fort and Prue Leith and Oliver, what's his face? And yeah, good format. Now it's they do starter and fish on the Wednesday, main course and dessert on the Thursday, and then so they only do it in 3 days. Yeah, it's good. It's really good. It's basically this series that's on at the moment is about they've all got to be cooking. My phone has just started started recording what I'm saying. It's always listening, isn't it?
Yeah. You're going to get stuff sold here now.
That's weird, though, isn't it? I hate it when they do that.
Big brother.
This one, they're cooking a banquet in Abbey Road. So the theme is music. And basically, they've all got these dishes and they're sort of tenuously linking it into music.
Yeah, I bet it's.
Some of them are like really interesting, but you just think it's remarkably unexciting for considering that the theme is music and it could be anything. They're just like bringing out like some guy brought out like a Cullen Skink or something and he said, yeah. I imagine this is what a lot of the musicians would have been eating in the 60s. And you go, that's not a link. Yeah. You haven't done a link there.
What have you got? Got a bowl of opal fruits, Ringo Starbursts.
There you go. Well, someone did an octopus dish and they called it Octopus's Garden. And right. You go, yeah, that's the sort of thing you should be doing, right? Sure. A champagne supernova. We've done a champagne dessert. You know, you go, yeah, great, that's fine. I remember one year the banquet was Comet Relief, right? And so they all had to do Comet Relief theme things, and all of the chefs came in, and they all like had the sense of humour of a PE teacher, right? And one guy, basically, he did a chocolate mousse dessert, and he made it look like dog shit.
I quite like that, though.
On a piece of grass,
that's good.
A piece of turf, right? And fucking hell, the judge went absolutely
really?
You can't serve that at a banquet. You can't bring out like what 250 dog turds on a fucking piece of lawn. And then the other guy who really panicked, I can't remember who it was, but the other guy who really panicked over Comet Relief, he had to he didn't have a sense of humour, or he was so scared and in the headlights. He just basically he could cook, but he didn't know how to link it into the theme. So for Comet Relief, his main dish was sort of like, his main dish was kind of like I think it was like a beef stew type thing, and it came out on giant stainless steel silver replicas of the Titanic. And it's kind of like, why is this funny? We're now remembering remembering the death of thousands of people that died in the icy water for Comet Relief. It's not even a related Comet Relief charity. It's not like it's part of the thing. And now we're going to have a look at the survivors of the Titanic. Please keep phoning in.
You know. If anything, it's wrong to have it. If you're going to send money to people who are starving, the last thing you want to do is have like
a banquet.
A banquet. Probably not in very good taste.
That would probably be delicious.
What was he thinking there? Was he having a meltdown? Is he like doing that thing where he's like, I don't know what to do? And I've gone, what is that? And he goes, it's a Titanic, a beef stew.
But the thing is, it's like, I don't know if they get a budget or what. They must have some sort of... Because I guess technically you could make cucumber sandwiches for like 60p and go, yeah, it's my spin on a classic British dish. You know, you could, you know... Mm. Or you could, like, people just, like...
So you actually have to cater for 60 people, that's how it...
250 people. Right. Not if you win. The prize is, like, you get to do the starter for the banquet. So four people go through. Sometimes one person gets the starter and a main course, you know. But a lot of the time they just, like, go, well, how do we make this a bit more special? And they throw caviar at it and go, there you go. So I guess there's no top end to it. So the thing is that when they get these props made... They're spending money on making these props. And he would have had to get 250 replicas of the Titanic made. It's fucking crazy.
But it must have been like, it feels like he must have been having a meltdown. Like, I can't think of what to do. And that it must be like he just kept going.
He must have had a meltdown. But it must have. But it was a pre-ordained. It was a pre-thought out.
No, I know.
It wasn't like a spontaneous meltdown. It was like he went weeks and maybe months in advance, going like Titanic. Comic relief.
So he's got. I've actually got a bit of paper, and he's gone like. Have you got any ideas? I got one. Titanic, but like beef stew and sat in the massive ship. We go, right, any other ideas? I can't think.
I could serve pate on Lenny Henry's face. Just slide him around the table on a lazy Susan.
Oh. I've got like the Hindenburg disaster, but with a sausage roll on the bottom. It like comes in on a big Zeppelin about to crash, but it's attached to a sausage roll that you can eat. I don't know. It's a sinking of Lusitania, but I've got like a jam roly poly on it. I don't know. World disasters with food plus comedy.
Yeah. So that's that. So anyway, it was quite warm in my room this morning. Yeah. Yesterday, but it was cold today. So keep warm, people.
And what's the second rule of fan club?
Please, for the love of God. Tell your friends. It's not lined up. That would have been great to just go into the song, but you were fucking around with something else. Thanks, Natalie. I love you. I love you too. Yeah, good. Thanks, you said it.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, stop pretending that you've never been bad. You
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Just fuck off. I always let the song fade out. Stop telling me what to do.
Yeah.
God.
Freedom to rock, freedom to talk.
Freedom to...
FUBAR Radio.
Freedom to rock, freedom to tuck. I mean, come on. We just, before we started on air... We were talking about the year 1989, how it's the 20th anniversary of Batman.
30th.
Fuck me. The 30th anniversary of Batman. And I was like saying that I think that was a really good year, 89 was. And of course it was. It also was the year of Look Who's Talking and Born on the 4th of July. A real vintage year. Never seen Born on the 4th of July, I have
to say.
I'll
tell you what, I wouldn't have guessed ever. That Batman wasn't the biggest movie that year.
Yeah.
You'd assume, if you said what was the biggest movie of 89, you'd 100% say Batman.
Yeah. What is also actually baffling, I mean, the top 10 for 1989, I mean, consider it, actually, these were the releases of 89, so I suppose it makes some sense that they're in this order.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising. Number one.
No, hang on, 10. Number 10, Born on the 4th of July. Yeah. 9, The Little Mermaid. 8,
Ghostbusters 2.
7,
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
6,
Lethal Weapon 2.
I'm surprised that's as low down.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are, really. Even Little Mermaid, I'm sort of surprised. I'm surprised Born the 4th of July is in the top 10 films.
So the top 5 films of 1989...
5 is a surprise.
5 is fucking bonkers when you put it above The Little Mermaid,
Lethal
Honey,
Weapon
I Shrunk
2.
The Kids, Ghostbusters 2, Born on the 4th... Well, not Born on the 4th of July. I'm surprised that's in the top 10.
Yeah.
Lethal Weapon 2. Fucking hell. Number 5 for 1989...
is Dead Poets Society.
Dead Poets Society. Then Look Who's Talking.
Sure.
Fucking hell, Look Who's Talking. That doesn't improve with age, does it?
No.
Fucking hell. Fucking, what a fucking mental idea for a fucking film.
But then to be such a big hit.
It had two sequels.
Yeah. So when Look Who's Talking came out, 89, John Travolta was probably going, yep, I'm back on top. He probably never would have imagined that he was going to get yet another comeback.
I mean, he's had a lot of comebacks, hasn't he? Oh, yeah. Famously at the time, it was just like, how many comebacks can... He was the comeback king. So what he did, Saturday Night Fever, Grease. And yeah, and then what happened then?
Then you've got like... Then but I think yeah,
but
everything
what
he
happened
did
to
probably,
his career then?
Yeah. Like, I guess he just was making like... I mean, things like Blowout, which is brilliant.
Sure.
It didn't make any money. So I guess he just did a... And at the time, would have been when Blowout came out, I think it was like, oh my God, we've got John Travolta. Amazing.
And it was, but I imagine it was just, it wasn't Grease, was it?
Yeah.
And it's quite violent and dark and darkly comic. I love that film. I think it's his best film.
Yeah.
So there's Blowout. And then he did Staying Alive, written and directed by Sylvester Stallone. And it was like, should we get the Bee Gees back? And he was like, no, my brother can write music. You go, what? So Frank Stallone followed up the Bee Gees. Still, it's like a, what, multi-platinum.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably one of the best-selling albums of all time, Saturday Night Fever.
How are we going to follow that up? Frank said, why have you deleted everything that's on the screen? We're looking at the screen. What are you doing? Oh no! Just stop. It was actually a good show today, isn't it? Scuppered. What were we talking about? And then, so then he did like I've seen a lot of John Travolta films. He did that one with Air Gross where he met Kelly Preston, set in Russia. Don't they go... The Experts. Is that what it's called?
Oh, right. Yeah.
The American, high school dropout stoner dudes that go over to Russia to teach them the American way of life. Is that what it is? I mean...
Have you ever seen, like, films like Best Defense? The one that's, like, the Dudley Moore film where,
well,
like...
Basically, they
make another film of Eddie Murphy in.
Yeah.
They cut in...
They made Best Defense. I think it's on... Is it on Netflix?
Oh, it might be.
Best Defense is an absolutely incredible film where they made
a terrible Dudley Moore film, and then to save it, they said, who's hot right now? Eddie Murphy. So they've just filmed
another film. They just intercut them,
and then they just put so there's these parallel films with Eddie Murphy and Dudley Moore. Dudley Moore's like this, a weapons designer. He works for like this weapons manufacturing plant, and it's like this comedy about this guy that doesn't know what he's doing, and it's rubbish. And then they went, right, well, what do we do? Well, we can't just insert Eddie Murphy into the Dudley Moore scenes. So we'll film Eddie Murphy in Afghanistan using the weapons. And so it's like there's this kind of like knockabout war caper, which must have cost a fuckload of money. They've gone, fucking hell, we've already thrown all it. I reckon the Dudley Moore movie must have cost 10 million. And they went, oh, God, it's shit. How do we save it? Well, we'll spend 50 million on this Eddie Murphy film. And I think it's in one of his, I can't remember what, I think Best Defense, I mean, I remember at the Oscars, they said to Eddie Murphy, what's your worst film? What's the film that you like the least? And he just went, I even love Norbit. Right, I'm not going to do an actual impression of Eddie Murphy, right? Because and yeah, he's got like he loves all of his films, and he's gone on the record of saying that Best Defense is like the worst thing that he's ever been in. And you go, fucking hell, fucking. That's so weird, though, that to save a film, they just filmed another film, and then they
would have probably had to get rid of like half the film that they'd already made.
I just remember it being really boring. Anyway, and then obviously. Pulp Fiction, and then that reinvented him. But like he had loads of films in the 80s and early 90s.
Yeah,
and like I've seen so many John Travolta films. That's quite a humble brag. Are we just going to come in and chat? Are we? thanks for the tea. Every time it happens, I just lose my thread. I find it very. It's just me going and ah on the radio.
But no, he has. He's had a million comebacks.
Yeah, and I keep meaning to rewatch Broken Arrow, but I don't.
So
know.
Do I.
I've got it. I've down. It was just at that time when Con Air was out, Broken Arrow was out, The Rock was out. Loved those films. I didn't quite. At the time, I loved Face Off.
Do you know what? I was really looking forward to Face Off, and I remember it being a real disappointment.
I think I convinced myself for a long time that it was better than it was.
Do you know what I really liked? Like Assassins. I thought it was great.
With Stallone?
Stallone and Antonio Banderas.
I thought Assassins was incredible.
So did I.
And I honestly, when I watched that film, there was a real moment at the end where I didn't know who was going to win.
Mm.
When you watch it back, Antonio Banderas is so over the top.
But I love that period, if I can speak. Desperado, I think, is tremendous, and I think Antonio Banderas in that period was such like a star for me. I was like, he's incredible, this guy.
Well, when he pops up in The Expendables 3, he just totally steals the film. He's just great in it. And Antonio Banderas, I mean, he doesn't get enough love. You almost forget that he made the Zorro films.
Yes, yeah,
and
yeah.
I was never really... I mean, I guess our next guest, we can talk about all the stuff with him. But that era... I think that era of Stallone was great. I mean, I even loved Judge Dredd. I think there's bits in Judge Dredd that obviously haven't aged that well. The special effects were absolutely incredible. And they stole like that speeder bike scene from Return of the Jedi in there. But the upgrade in special effects at the time was worth it, I think.
There's just lots of good stuff in Judge Dredd.
I think there's... I mean, obviously, we took the helmet off and all that. And you go, yeah. But these are just things... I was never like a... Obviously, I was aware of Judge Dredd, the character, but I was never like a huge comic... Judge Dredd comic book fan, so I was a Stallone fan, and I didn't mind it. Although I do agree that it stops becoming a Judge Dredd movie.
Yeah, but I think there's some really great visuals in that, and I think there's a lot of the imagery of it really sort of stayed with me.
I think the score's really good, I just really like it. I really like it. But I would be interested. Obviously, people say there was huge budget cuts, so that there's this bit when all of these clones get released at the end.
Mm.
instead of having this fight with all these clones, they just blow up. They get hatched and then they blow up straight away.
I suppose Stallone never really went away, but I remember like Cliffhanger feeling like a real relaunch of his career. Like I'm still absolutely relevant and I'm still doing it.
Stallone went away. Rocky V was 90. Then he did Oscar and Stop and My Mom Will Shoot. And he was a joke.
So it was then. Yeah, I remember it feeling like a real comeback.
So when he did Cliffhanger, that was sort of like to launch Planet Hollywood as well. So there was that Aspel episode of Planet Hollywood.
Striking Distance for Willis.
Which is a terrible film, although it's got a really good soundtrack. Oh, look, we've got 10 minutes, so we should probably... we're going to talk about all this stuff later, I'm sure, yes. And if not...
We've got some post.
I tell you what, Doris died this week. Doris Day died this week, which is sad. She was 97. I tweeted about it, but one of the things that I found interesting was that I typed in Doris Day movies on my Skybox, and it came up with three films. And it was That Touch of Mink with Cary Grant. I can't remember what the Rock Hudson film was called.
Pillow Talk?
Send Me No Flowers, I think it was. And there was The Man Who Knew Too Much, which is famous. Alfred Hitchcock, James Stewart, Doris Day, and it's the film where she sang Que Sera Sera.
Yeah, in a Hitchcock thriller.
That just stop everything, and then she sings Que Sera Sera. That's where the song comes from. That's what's famous. What makes it famous. But you look at those films, those leading men. There's Cary Grant. He died in 86. Rock Hudson died in 85. James Stewart died as late as 97, which I didn't realise it was that late. Yeah. So he probably one of the last things he saw was Con Air.
Well, good for him.
Good for him. At least he got there. Mm. She...
I can lie now. I've seen Con Air.
You look at That Touch of Mink and... It's just bizarre how the aging process has changed for people now. Because Cary Grant, what was it? It was made in the early 60s, I think it was. He's in his grey hair period. Mm. It's not totally grey. He's not North... When was North by Northwest made? 59?
I think later. 63? We'll see.
Well, when was That Touch of Mink made, I suppose, is the more important question. But... So Cary Grant is old, so he must be like mid-50s, I would say. Doris Day doesn't look that much younger. Looked it up, and she's like... Either I've got my maths wrong, or it's just crazy. She's like 22.
Oh, wow. Okay, maybe that explains why.
Well, it explains how she's outlived all these people.
Yeah.
But Doris Day was such a big name, and then it's kind of like, I don't really know... Shirley Temple, obviously another big name from that era, sort of, maybe a bit before... And she's now like a UN ambassador, or she was. Is she still around?
I don't know, actually.
But I just think that it's out of all of those people, you know, she was like one of the surviving icons of the, was it the golden age of cinema?
Yeah, well, I suppose you've got Kirk Douglas still, haven't you, who's remarkably still knocking about.
Still around. But I would say that he was a different league, and maybe a bit later.
Yeah, he's 50s and 60s, isn't he?
I would say, yeah, he's more modern than... ridiculously, he feels more modern than Cary Grant.
Right.
You know, James Stewart, Cary Grant, they're all kind of like... Gregory Peck, Audrey Hepburn, Catherine Hepburn.
Yeah, Cary Grant and Humphrey James Bogart, Stewart are making films in the 30s.
Humphrey Bogart feels like a little bit before Cary Grant.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But... They're all of that era.
Cary Grant had a whole period where he wasn't in films, though. There's like a 10-year period where he just stops making films because I think he's got enough money. He was never attached to a studio. And I think he's got one of those sort of real... one of those lives where he just kind of did what he wanted, I think. And I think his life always seems fascinating. Mm. But I think when he comes back in like To Catch a Thief, when he's got the grey hair and things, I think it's like the first film he's made in 10 years, and it's just like... Hitchcock goes, you want to make a film? He goes, yeah. I think that's when he's in his sort of mad period
taking LSD at the weekends. Anyway, Doris Day, maybe we could download Que Sera Sera for the closing credits. We haven't got credits. So me and Nat. And Nat. And Theo. Okay, so we're going to do some emails while you open that, yeah?
Yeah.
Turn it down, Nick. I will, I'm doing it. Fucking hell. Hello, first time listener, long time fan. loving what I've heard so far. Can you tell me a bit more about you and the show so I can decide if I want to commit to you? 4.5 stars. I just want all the listeners to know right now that this show might be a shambles, but it's not my fault. Hello, first time listener, long time fan. Loving what I've heard so far. Can you tell me a bit more about you and the show so I can decide if I want to commit to you? Well, you're a long time listener, first time listener, long time fan though. So what more do you need to know about me? Or not, I don't know. You haven't addressed it to either of us. 4.5 stars for the one I heard. That's five. You got that wrong. Do you like Ken Roach films? Do you like Ken Roach films?
Ken Roach?
Ken Roach?
Not Ken Loach.
Is that Ken Loach's drug-addicted cousin?
Yes! Thanks, Torpin. Bernie Torpin.
Is that Ken Roach? Is that Ken Loach's insect brother?
Yeah.
Doesn't work like that. It'd be the same surname.
Ken Roach.
Thanks, Torpin.
Torpin. Bernie Torpin.
Bernie Torpin.
Might be.
Maybe. I can't answer any of that email because I don't really understand it, but good luck with the crack.
Big fan of Ken Roach.
Oh, look. More Hitchcock chat, please. Barry Venison. Didn't we have this last week?
We had Barry Venison already, didn't we? It's a new one.
Perfect show for those of us who are slightly mentally interesting. We had this last week. Keep it light. I'm quite a few months behind. Yes, we've had this last week. Looking forward to the inevitable NISA sponsorship. Yes, we've had this last week. But no spoilers, please. Absolutely. We've had this last week. Update dash. I've just reached Nick talking about Marnie. Totally agree. Shadow of a Doubt is the best for me. I don't remember any of that. Maybe we didn't have it last week. Maybe they've just...
I like Shadow of the Doubt a lot.
And is that it for what we've got for fan mail? Come on, guys. Keep sending that fan mail in.
We've got some posts.
Yeah, but is that all we've got to read out? Oh, my God. This is getting worse and worse. I mean, fucking... I think our fans are dropping off like flies. that's fan club.
We have got... We've been sent... A big letter, which I'll read after the show, because I didn't expect a big letter.
Yeah, well, we've got 3 minutes. Can you not zip through it? Are you meant to read it out on air?
I don't know. But it's from Dave Russell, and he has sent us...
Dave Russell, that's ironic, because you made a lot of fucking noise when you were opening it. Am I right?
Yes. He has sent us... What is that? Gun loading and cock. Gunshot and cock. The 007 diaries we were talking about. The one where...
amazing.
Where Roger Moore shits himself in Jamaica and things.
Oh, that's great. He sent the book, yeah?
Yeah.
Did he send 2 copies of the book?
No, he didn't.
Oh, I guess we're just going to have to sit side by side and read it together then, fucking hell. That's a really...
But thank you
that's
very
a really,
much, Dave Russell.
It's a sort of a thoughtful gift, but it's also a thoughtless gift. Right, there's two of us. The clue's in the fucking title. If you're going to send anything in, people, this is serious, actually. I hate to end the gift section with a telling off, but if you are going to send anything, make sure you send in 2 of everything. Right, we're not the Beatles. We don't live together, so fucking sort it out. All right. Otherwise, Nat's got to wait for me to read it, and I'm a slow reader, or I've got to wait for him to read it, and he has dirty fingers. So, come on. I think we're on time.
I think we are. Thank you, Dave. I'll have a read of the thing as well, and if it seems appropriate. But thank you very much for the book.
Thanks for
perfect.
That. So we're now going to play a song... what's your song called?
Oh, Joe Breath. Take Me, I'm Yours.
That's right. Keep listening, guys. We've got a fun-packed hour ahead.
Anything for you. On FUBAR Radio.
We're back in the studio after listening to, obviously, we didn't, we just played that track, they weren't live. but if you listen on iTunes, we cut the music out, so you don't know what we're talking
about.
They
get a bit, didn't they? They get a bit.
They're fine. We're joined in the studio now by prolific YouTuber Oliver Harper.
Hello, chaps, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. Oliver's a bit quiet in my ears, so.
He's in mine.
I mean, she's looking, she's coming in. But we can still.
There we go.
Is that it?
Is that the problem?
It's just you went near enough. Really didn't need, you could have just mimed through the glass. Yeah, anyway, so you make YouTube retrospective videos of old films.
I do indeed.
Well,
yes.
I say old films, but films that we pretty much all grew up with.
Yeah, 80s and 90s.
When were you born?
Where?
When?
When, 1982.
Oh, right, yeah. I was 1980. When were you?
79.
That's right, that little bit older than me. That's right. So, yeah, these are all like the films that we all grew up with. And I think maybe the video that you made that got my main attention was the Milton Keynes Superman 4 video that you made.
Oh, Superman 4, yeah, The Man of Steel and Glass. Yeah, it's basically about the locations of Superman 4, because Canon Films, we know, as we all know, were very cheap. So they decided to shoot Milton Keynes to double for New York, Elstree Studios, which they owned during the 80s. They bought that because Canon had a huge surge in money, so they ended up buying...
For a while, they ended up buying just about every cinema, didn't they, in the UK?
Canon?
Yeah. I think they bought the ABC
cinema. Yeah, right, Canon were a cinema chain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten all about that.
Yeah.
People refer to as the flea pit cinemas.
Right. Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh. I'd forgotten all about that. Yeah, but they may have bought the ABC. They didn't buy all the ABCs, though, right?
No, they bought... I think... I'm not sure about how many they actually bought in total, but they bought loads in Europe as well.
Right.
So, yes, the documentary was sort of detailing those locations because no one had done it before. I mean, people had gone and taken photographs and stuff, and there's a recreation video.
But why do you think that people went and took photos? Is it because geographically it was easier to get to Milton Keynes than it was to get to New York?
Well, of course.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Because everyone goes, well, if you,
for English people, obviously, if you live in New York, be easier to take photos in New York. Don't bother going to Milton Keynes. You'll get photos of the first three. But yeah.
Yeah, so it was.
So did Canon take over from Warner Brothers?
No.
So Warner Brothers did Superman.
Well, yes. Superman. Well, the thing is about the Superman license was it, because it was picked up by the Solkinds. So then they owned it essentially. So they distributed it through Warner Brothers, who paid them for the rights for the USA. Right. In the UK, I think it was Thorne EMI and Warner.
Right.
Like the first three. And then Superman 4, when the Solkinds had kind of sold it off at Cannes for like, I don't know, I think it was like $5 million or something like that to Canon. They decided to push forward with Superman, and Warner Brothers would distribute it.
Sorkins weren't involved in the fourth one at all?
Not at all, no. But then he leased it to Canon for a short period of time. Then I think it may have reverted back to them, because they were going to do Superman 5, I think, in the early 90s.
But the Sorkins didn't treat the franchise that well, did they?
What, to begin with?
To begin with.
Yeah. I mean, I think... Go on.
Well, they threw the money at it. That's one thing. They didn't cut corners... Mm. That often. I mean, Supergirl, I mean, that was a massive budget movie, but ultimately it was a massive bomb. And then they hired the same director to do Santa Claus, the movie, and spent even more money
on
that.
I love those films.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think Superman the movie really made Superman, as someone who liked kind of Superman comics, I think it really took all the mythology, which was really not really anything in the comics, and actually made it make sense.
Yeah.
And I think all that kind of Mario Puzo kind of putting this big sort of epic structure onto it is kind of what made Superman. And it's what the comics followed, really, and went, oh yeah, we'll have a bit of that.
But you can't disassociate the production of Superman from Superman 2, which was a fucking disaster, the way that they put together Superman 2. So you can go like, oh, Superman, but they were basically filming two films at the same time. They were fucking... they fucked off Richard Donner, replaced him with Richard Lester eventually. Richard Donner came on board for Superman 2, and then they brought in sort of Richard Lester as sort of like his understudy, and then phased him out.
Yeah, that's Richard Lester was brought on to supervise Donner, sort of be the go-between between the Solkinds. Well, basically Pierre Spengler, who Richard Donner just despised at that point, didn't want to talk to him. So come finishing Superman the movie, he was getting ready to do Superman 2. They said, they no longer need your services, so Richard Donner, because I think he said publicly that he wouldn't work with Pierre Spengler again. So they put in Richard Lester, who was fast director, economical, and also they still owed him money from the Musketeers.
Right.
The fourth one, wasn't it? Because they shot them back to back, then released the fourth
they
one,
shot two
well,
back
four Musketeers.
Back. What was the fourth one? I thought there was.
Well, there was the three Musketeers and the four.
There's the four Musketeers.
There's the three Musketeers, four Musketeers.
That's the sequel, isn't it?
And then there was the Return of the Musketeers, which was late '80s, which is the one that
Roy Kinnear
fell off a horse and died.
Well, that was directed by Lester. I think that was the last film he ever did.
I think it was. Yeah, yeah. I think that was Lester again.
And then I think he went into like commercials.
I just think he's such a interesting. When I say interesting, I mean weird director. There's a lot of it, and just the way he does sort of ADR on stuff like Help, where they're sort of the bit when they're in the Bahamas and they're all running around, and he's just adding on. When I was little, I couldn't tell the difference between the Beatles. And so he adds on sort of like mumbling and voiceovers in really sort of like long shots where they're tiny in the distance. You can't really work out who it is. And he kind of like adds in these voiceover things to make it funnier. And then when you watch The Three Musketeers, there'll be kind of like a scene. And then in the foreground, two peasants walk past And then he'll give them sort of like a little chat that they're having, and they'll be talking about a duck that's in the way. And go, oh, look, we're just walking down the road and there's a duck in the way now. And he'll just add in all these things. And you go, that's fucking crazy. I just think, who does that?
But I think, yeah, he was though, wasn't he? Richard Lester was like around in the sort of late 50s, early 60s. And I think he seems much more of that Spike Milligan-y, goonish kind of...
Yeah, I suppose that's what it is. And Spike Milligan was in Musketeers, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Richard Lester's more about slapstick humour. And that's sort of kind of evident in Superman 2 with the sort of additional stuff. And then Superman 3.
Superman 3, it's just like right up top. He does the whole... what do you call that thing when something kicks into another thing and then it's like that delicious machine or something? What do you call that?
Oh, Exquisite Corpse.
No, it's not Exquisite Corpse because that's the game.
Yeah, yeah.
But like in the Saw franchise, when something kicks into something else and then that... Like there's a chain reaction.
Screwball scramble.
Just call it a chain reaction. it's like Mousetrap. there's like this chain reaction sequence at the beginning of Superman 3 where you go, that's ridiculous. So I think one of the things that I like most about Army of Darkness would be that Sam Raimi uses the same approach with all the skeletons in the batter at the end, where there'll be one of my favourite lines from Army of Darkness is right at the beginning, where a knight goes up to his car and starts hitting it, and then the camera pans away, and off shot you just hear someone go, "What a piece of armour this is!" And it's just like he gives like all of these sort of like non-characters these little personalities, and he like fills it all that, and I think that must come from someone like Richard Lester.
Well, Sam Raimi's very much influenced by the Three Stooges, wasn't he? Because like Army of Darkness, which kind of upset a lot of the hardcore fans of Evil Dead, because it was just threw in tons more humour, and it was kind of watered down in terms of like violence. But to me, that's one of my favourites out of there.
If you jump from Evil Dead to Army of Darkness, you go, what the fuck's happening here? Yeah. But if you Evil Dead 2 is the stepping stone to get you there. And also, what I admire about that franchise or that trilogy is that they didn't repeat themselves. They didn't just like, even though Evil Dead 2 is sort of a rehash. I mean, the first 10 minutes of the remake and then the rest of it is the sequel, but it's still a guy on his own in a cabin. It's sort of a rehash or a stripped down version of the first one. It's more, they've added the comedy into it, so it's not a repeat of the first one. And then the third one, they've gone for a Ray Harryhausen action adventure fantasy. That was the first one I saw.
That's the first one I saw as well, because when I saw Evil Dead 2, I thought, wait a minute, is this like a sequel or a prequel to it? Because I had no idea what was going on.
They were connected.
Because it didn't have Evil Dead 3 on it.
Right.
So I was completely like, oh my God, this is amazing. Who's this character with a chainsaw?
I really preferred the title Medieval Dead when they did the third one. I thought they should have stuck with that.
I think that's on the UK poster they got, Medieval Dead. I think it's like a underline.
Yeah, I think that it was. What was that free magazine that used to get in cinemas?
Flicks.
So in Flicks, and there was a shot of Bruce Campbell, and it said, I think Evil Dead 3 or Medieval Dead or whatever it was. And there was a little description of it. And back then, I couldn't tell the difference between Night of the Living Dead, Return of the Living Dead, Evil Dead, like all of those dead franchises. So they were all one. And so that they were kind of like Return of the Living Dead 3 had just come out, which was completely different from... I mean, that's just as much of a genre change from Return of the Living Dead to Return of the Living Dead 3, where Return of the Living Dead is this satire on zombie movies.
Well, it's like Dawn of the Dead, then there's Zombie. Then there's Zombie 2, then it becomes this kind of... Wasn't it the title of the film was changed in parts of Europe, maybe Italy?
Yeah,
then you had a whole new series of zombie series.
Yes, yeah, so I think in Italy they just don't care about sequels. They just or having rights to anything.
You've got me Alien 2, the Italian version of Alien 2, which I've started, and I'm not lying, 15 times and not got through it.
It's not very good. It's just
interesting that there's a sequel to Ridley Scott's Alien, an Italian sequel to Ridley Scott's Alien that has nothing to do with it, set on Earth. It's crazy. But because it all started with the original Night of the Living Dead, where they changed the title on the poster at the last minute and they didn't copyright it. And then that is up for grabs in terms of anyone can... it's out of copyright, basically, because it was never copyrighted in the first place. So when they made the sequel, that's why like George Romero didn't own Of the Living Dead. So then when he did the sequel, it was just Day of the Dead.
It isn't like Night of the Living Dead.
Or Dawn
like,
of the Dead.
It's in public domain. Yeah. The whole film is. Isn't
public
it?
Domain.
That's why it's been re-released so many times. Yeah. But then he has to way remade it, like in 1990, maybe 89.
Was that Tom Savini?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, he actually owns that one.
He owns the Tom Savini one?
I think so, yeah.
And who was the lead in that?
Oh, I can't remember.
There was one with Tony Todd in.
It was a good remake, though. I quite like
well,
that.
Well, there was another remake that was in 3D. I think that was maybe the one with Tony Todd in.
Really?
That was more recent. It's just great. But also, then there was that. There was Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, starring Ving Rhames, and then there was a remake of Day of the Dead, also starring Ving Rhames, which wasn't a sequel to Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, but it was a remake of the original Day of the Dead, but it wasn't set in an army facility and it had a different story. And it's just crazy. You gather just the George A. Just all of the films that are offshoots from Night of the Living Dead are just confusing enough. Yeah. And then when you get to Return of the Living Dead, which is basically going, hey, you know that movie Night of the Living Dead? Well, that's based on a true story, and we've got the stuff that the, you know, in our basement at this facility, and then they let out all this toxic gas, and then people stop coming. I mean, Return of the Living Dead is a great film. Return of the Living Dead 2, not so great. And Return of the Living Dead 3 is just this straight zombie, low-budget zombie film that's like meant to be like Romeo and Juliet, but isn't. And so I got Army of Darkness mixed up with all of that. Anyway, Richard Lester.
King of the Tangents, eh?
Yeah. Oh, it's good, it's good.
Right. That's all this
that's
is.
That's fan club. That's all this is. It's just tangents.
Tangent club.
But Superman 3 is your favourite out of all the Supermans?
No, it's not, actually. Like, Superman the movie is, but no. I'm not sure most people know about that movie in and out. If you're a film fan, I think you've already discussed some of the production stuff before.
Yeah.
I've caught up with some of your episodes. So I thought Superman 3, because it is like, for me, it's guilty pleasure. Objectively, it's not a brilliant film. But to me, I think it was like the first one I ever saw as a kid. I think it was on BBC One. My mum still says to me, oh, it's the first film you saw. That's how you got into it. I was like, no. Must be number 3. Because all I remember as a kid was seeing that robot.
Yeah.
That's terrifying. Oh,
I was
absolutely
talking to my friend Jamie, Jamie the guitarist, who listens to the show. He was talking about Superman 3 and how that, I think a lot of people's childhoods were ruined by that robot.
That absolutely scared
the life out
of me. Absolutely
one of the most fucking terrifying things.
The whole sequence is, like, they have no score, there's no music, it's just that woman screaming as she just sees the metal.
It's like the tree rape scene in the first Evil Dead, where, you know, there's, like, stuff attaching to her face, and it's all... But when you watch it back now, it's like they've just sprayed her silver.
Sort of. But what's also weird is she's Robert Vaughn's sister, and there's this idea that she's dead. As well, she's like, she gets the full brunt of it.
Yeah, I think it's like I think suppose it's because she was such a bit of a bitch throughout the entire film, and then she gets punished by turning into this machine, and then when it all just gets destroyed, she's kind of okay. You kind of see it as like crawling over, like or just waking up, because no one dies.
Sure.
I think Superman 3 is an underrated film, and I really like it. I think it's a film that I think about a lot, and I kind of quote bits from Superman 3. The bit with Richard Pryor when he comes in with a big cowboy hat, he's knocking on the thing and starts going, oh, we're in trouble, ain't we? I say that all the time.
Well, it's a really bizarre, there's so many jokes you kind of miss as a kid. And then when you hear, like, Robert Vaughn gets Richard Pryor up to his office, he goes, you've been a very naughty boy, haven't you? And he says, oh, I don't want to go to jail because I've got rapists and robbers and rapists who rape robbers.
Yeah.
So that's like, as a kid, that, you know, you don't hear that. But as an adult, you're like, whoa, they got away with that in a PG.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it was...
I think it's great. I think it's a much underrated film.
Superman 3?
Yeah.
I tell you what, Superman 3, on its own, you go, yeah, sure. Christopher Reeve is still Christopher Reeve. As a sequel to the original Superman, it's fucking insane. But also, it's the first film that they made after they knew what they had.
Yeah.
So they made Superman 1 and 2 back-to-back, or they made Superman 1... and half of Superman 2 back to back. And then they put all of that. Because the ending of. Did we talk about this the other week? The ending of Superman 1. I mean, it's easy to repeat.
I thought I was worried you might be repeating yourself.
The ending of Superman 1 was the original ending for Superman 2. And then
we did.
We did talk about that. But, you know.
Well, Superman 3 is like a great standalone adventure for Superman.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I think it's like a Bond film. You don't have to be invested in like the backstory or anything like that. You can watch it with a group of friends. I don't have to know anything about Superman or the lore of Superman.
Yeah.
Just go straight into it. And that's what I like about it. Because it's one of the one out of all of them, it's the one you can watch with like four or five people and just get drunk and just watch Superman.
Or on your own.
Or on your own, yeah.
I think there's so much stuff about it I like that. And again, like as a kid, I didn't make those distinctions between them. They're just Superman films. Yeah. And this is the one where it's like, this would be the one at school where it's like, this is the one where he goes bad. And he proves he's bad by flicking some peanuts at some bottles of whiskey and smashing them because he's evil. He's pure evil, this guy. And doesn't his suit go a bit darker?
Doesn't he get a blowjob?
No, he sleeps with Pamela Stevenson.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Like, what's that, Lorelai?
But isn't there a bit when he sort of like pushes her down?
He gets a bit rapey, doesn't he?
Does he?
Yeah.
Oh, it's uncomfortable.
It's been a while.
It's uncomfortable in 2019. Uncomfortable viewing.
Well, he straightens the statue and the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
I didn't actually realise that this was going to be the thing we were talking about, but I bought you these from over the road. They're all broken up because they all are.
Candy sticks with tattoo.
He lost caring. He stopped caring.
I got a pack of these the other week and they didn't have a tattoo in them. They didn't even have a tattoo.
That's a free temporary tattoo.
We could talk about Superman 3 all day.
But do you know what, though? I was just about to say, do you know
have I given a fair argument?
I feel like it.
I think it's fine. I mean, I prefer it infinitely to Man of Steel and.
I prefer
that Superman to. Bryan Singer's Superman.
Superman Returns.
Superman Returns and Man of Steel.
I always kind of feel that I want to stick up for Superman Returns, especially given what came afterwards. I always felt how you do it.
I don't understand why it's so hard to just make a Superman film. You know.
But I think Warner Brothers or people in the studio think for some reason Superman's not very cool. So they have to try and make him. But as you saw with Man of Steel, he's very angry and grumpy, and he's not really the Superman we all grew up watching. He's not Christopher Reeve. He's not George Reeves. He's not even Dean Cain.
But he's not even the idea that we all have in our head of what Superman is. If we all know. I think pretty much everyone knows what Superman is, and then you watch Man of Steel and you go, "That's not Superman."
Well, you want to see Superman saving people, smiling and winking at camera, sort of thing. You want to see him doing heroic stuff, not screaming and shouting,
I suppose. There's a bit in Man of Steel that I remember. There's a bit where he punches a Kryptonian and he smashed through some, like, scaffolding or something. It's got one of those signs in the background, which is, this site has had no accidents in X amount of days.
Yeah.
And they smash through it. And I always think the joke for Superman would be to him to do that, about to fly up, and then he puts zero on, as if to say, that's the right thing to do. And I think that's how you should do Superman.
Yeah.
It should be like, and I always think Superman is like, it's the idea of it is it's an alien who comes to America, is raised by Americans, and then because he's an alien, has to be the best example of being a human being.
He's raised by Midwestern Americans, and they're like the most American of all Americans.
Yeah.
So that's what, basically it's what they did with Captain America.
Yeah,
where they go, like this.
Well, it shows you, Marvel has shown us, haven't they, that you can take a character that could be perceived as campy or old-fashioned and make him popular. Mm. Captain America is a perfect example.
Yeah.
Because he's basically Superman. Yeah. Same ideals and stuff.
I mean, they have done it. And they've done it in Superman the movie as well. So that's why that works really
they
well.
They have done it, but they've done it more recently in a more cynical time with Captain America. And you go, they haven't, they've stayed true to what Captain America is and still updated it.
Yeah.
Whereas with Superman, it was just like, well, do you know what? We should probably change what Superman is, which is kind of a weird
approach. I think they were basically for years, like they were screwed on making any more because Christopher Reeve had his accident.
Hmm.
And I think he
said did he own any of the rights?
No. But he said he would do more if the money was spent. This is in like 94, so very not long afterwards he had his accident.
I think Warner Brothers. He said that before the accident.
Yeah, I think Warner Brothers basically said they would have. I think they would have made more if he, didn't break his neck. But the whole for years trying to find the right person to play Superman.
I suppose, yeah, it's a bit, it's a difficult. Bit fucking awful replacing
him. I mean,
him
there is a weird thing. The Brandon Routh thing was weird because he's someone who looks he's almost like a lookalike.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like, they've gone for like.
He doesn't really look that much like him, but he had exactly the same tone as him. Mm. And I just think, give him another chance. Just let him make another one.
Yeah, because he's got. You know, he said he's got more acting jobs under his belt. You know, I think he's improved as an actor. I think, in terms of things I've seen recently with him. But
I thought he was great in the first one. But what I would say was that nobody wants to see Superman, you know, stalking Lois Lane. And then you've got yourself lumbered with, oh, Superman's got a super baby now. Like, you can't make a sequel to this film.
The weirdest things about 3 and 4 of Superman is the thing where Lois Lane stops being, like, the love interest, and it's weird.
She becomes, like, a mother to him, like, the fourth one especially.
And it's like, but she's still around. She's still around, but they're not really... It's and he's basically with Lana Lang in the third one.
But that's because she fell out with the Sorkins.
Mm. But it makes that whole romance be like it's odd that she's still in the movies, but that romance has been completely sidelined.
Yeah. I've always thought that.
Whereas the first one,
and Margot Kidder was great, and then when you look at Kate Bosworth, it's just like, why have you cast her? She's blonde and she's obviously got dyed hair, and B, she's way too young. Margot Kidder was kind of like, I mean, she wasn't young when she made Superman, but she was like exactly right for that part. Yeah. And I just thought that. Yeah.
I always thought if they made it in the 90s, a new one, it would have been Courtney Cox as Lois Lane. Right. She's got that Margot Kidder kind of energy.
Yeah,
but then,
good.
You know, I mean, we say all that, but then Terry Hatcher and Dean Cain were good.
They were okay. I like Terry Hatcher, but I wasn't really a fan of Dean Cain because it wasn't the Superman I knew. It was this. They premiered it, I think, on the BBC One on my birthday as well. And it's like, oh, this is a new Superman show, amazing. And then no John Williams theme, and the suit looks like it's been made by his mum, which it is in the comics, but it doesn't look a bit.
It's very shiny.
It's gone to a Halloween shop and bought one. You know, sure. Yeah, very shiny, yeah. And it was played for sort of comedy.
Well, they didn't have the budget to make it anything other than that.
No.
Well, he wouldn't fly into a thing. He would sort of like step through a wall and it was like a polystyrene. I
like
it.
I mean, that's
the
thing that blew my mind. Like with Superman 4, I have said this before on here, where that was the first instance of seeing a film and realising that some films are terrible. And as a kid being like, huh? And like expecting like new Superman film out and so excited for it. And watching this thing.
You
going,
saw the cinema, did you?
Yeah, and being like, this is shit.
Oh my God.
So and I remember like thinking that. So I would have been 8 when it came out. And there was all, and I'm really noticing all the stuff. Like I really was aware of him not even changing on screen. And he'd go, can you not afford a shirt? Just tear a button off a shirt.
This is 8-year-old you.
And it's that kind of awareness of it and just going, almost like the whole concept of what movies were in my head were like, and being aware that this is no good. It's like, but this is rubbish. I didn't get it.
I didn't think like that. I remember thinking to myself, oh, I can see the wires there. But it didn't really bother me.
You can even see the curtain. When they're on the moon.
That was a sort of a... Well, I saw it on film, like, a couple of years ago, and you can't see the curtains. It's just a transfer to DVD. It wasn't really good.
It's just the concept of film but criticism.
That's unforgivable, though, isn't it? Yeah. If that's what the trend... That's the love of the film.
Well, you'd probably see the curtains if you increased the brightness, you know, then you'd see it.
I probably felt like that with Masters of the Universe, where my dad took me to see that, and I was like, going, what the fuck is this shit? What the fuck is this? Why is Orko not in it? Where's fucking...
I think there is that. There must be a point where people just see something and go, oh. Like, because all films before that are amazing. Because the only films you ever see are like massive blockbusters or Disney movies.
If Supergirl gets a pass,
amazing.
And you say, oh, Supergirl, yeah, that's fine. That's
fine. All right, Supergirl.
Santa
Claus
the movie, special effects are out of this world. And then you go see Masters of the Universe and you go, oh no. Why is it set on Earth?
That film has no extras in it. There's no people in the city. Just got those characters. You've got Skeletor coming through this massive porthole.
Yeah, but there's fucking loads of those soldiers, though. So any extras would have been armour put on them.
Recently, was it the Avengers Infinity War? There's a bit where they're in Edinburgh and there's no one there. They smash Waverley Station and no one witnesses it.
But it's like where they set the end of that one in an airport and you go... It's just set in an airport. There's no one around, and you're set in an airport. That's the knock-on effect from Man of Steel, isn't it? It was just like, we can't put them in a place where you're going to kill loads of innocent bystanders. So we'll just put them in deserted places now, and then they'll have these fights.
Well, if you feel like watch like Spectre, you know, when he's bombing around Italy at, like, I don't know, midnight, and it's empty. I'm like, no, come on. There must be more people around at this point.
But yeah. Then
especially tourists.
There's that Daniel Craig extra from Casino Royale that's doing the sweeping in the background. And the broom is a foot off the ground. Because he's obviously been told. He's been told, right, it's quiet on set. Everyone mime your actions. And he's in the back of the So, you know, it's probably sometimes for the best to not have any extras. Not that it's not a good enough and decent enough career path.
Do you know anything about the Zack? Because there's that Superman. I don't even know if. I presume this is true. In fact, I do know it's true because I've seen the Sulkeens reference it. Is that the third one is meant to be Mr. Mixia's Pidlick and.
And Brainiac.
Brainiac, right? Yeah.
So Ilya Sulkind had written like a pitch or like a brief to say, this is what he wants to do for Superman 3. And it would have, yeah, Mixia's Pidlick. Brainiac and Supergirl appearing in it, and the Warner Brothers said, "No, this is just like, you know, too crazy, too big, cost too much."
Because Dudley Moore was like either cast or.
So oh, I remember when I they didn't did hear that.
Yeah, when they did Santa Claus the movie, Dudley Moore's thing was that he knew them because he was supposed to be in Superman 3.
Ooh, there you go, new bit of trivia.
Yeah, but well, like, so that was a. Well, that's something that seems like a much more obvious third one, really.
It's full-on cosmic DC
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, it feels like, oh, yeah, that would make sense as a third. It makes more sense than Richard, what you get.
Richard Pryor in a Superman adventure.
Yeah, yeah.
It's weird. But then also Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, that's the one with the whales, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah.
So that was originally conceived. The reason it was set in San Francisco was because Paramount owned Beverly Hills Cop and... Star Trek, and they wanted to put Eddie Murphy into the Star Trek movie because they found out he was a fan. And then that didn't happen for some reason, but they still set it in modern times.
Maybe Shatner put his foot down. Or Nimoy.
Or Nimoy. I mean,
yeah. Nimoy was
they were
enjoyed,
both outspoken,
really?
Weren't they?
Yeah.
yeah. But that would have been pretty much the same as.
Yeah.
Let's put a comedian in a franchise.
Yeah.
That's fucking weird.
Well, the idea that at that time...
What Eddie Murphy be
Eddie
doing
Murphy's
in a Star
just been
Trek
brought
movie?
Up.
But not like Eddie Murphy coming in like Christian Slater, like as an officer. And
it's
just
best
like
defense again.
It would be like... It would literally be Axel Foley turns up on a Star Trek adventure. yeah. They wouldn't... No one would want to compete with him.
No.
Fine. We're going to play... you also love Laserdiscs. We're going to play a song now, and then we will talk some more with Oliver Harper. What is your song? Oh, it's your favourite song.
Oh, is it?
No, not really.
That's my favourite.
Is it this one?
Oh, yeah. We'll be right back.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're back in the studio with Oliver Harbour. You're a YouTuber.
Oh, yes.
How did you start that?
How, really? I mean, it's 2011 I started doing YouTube hobby.
That's 2011?
Yes. And because I worked as a projectionist for like seven years.
Maybe. Were they in the 35mm days?
Oh, yes. Yeah, 35mm. And I left due to them changing over to digital.
What cinema?
Cineworld.
And they changed over to digital and you were outraged.
I wasn't outraged. I mean, I knew I needed to move on at some point, but it was, you know, when I left, they'd had half 35 and the rest digital. And then they're basically phasing out all the projectionists. So they'd be replaced along the line, more digital projectors and one giant server. Film comes on a hard drive, upload it. People downstairs, the managers just create a playlist and then Bob's your uncle, done.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that why when stuff is out of focus, it takes fucking ages for it to be sorted?
Oh, yeah, they've got to get the usher or people shoveling popcorn and go, oh, I've got one upstairs now, and then adjust the focus and or restart the projector.
Because it's not manual. Oh, obviously, it's not manually operated anymore, but that's just...
Yeah, so replace them all with
that's
two...
That's just a shame, isn't it? You might as well just be watching the Blu-ray.
Yeah. I mean, I think the quality has dropped as well, because they're all 2K projectors and not 4K in a lot of cinemas. 35mm is beyond that resolution. So you've had a drop in quality, I think, really, picture-wise. But you don't get, you know, the scratches, you don't get the film cutting up, whatever. So consistent.
But I call that
quality,
I mean, the stuff like that that makes it feel like cinema to me.
It's that experience of growing up and watching those films in cinema yourself, and then when it's all like digital, you're just watching like it's like watching a Blu-ray on a massive projector.
Yeah. I remember finding out about that thing when the reels end and you get the little mark.
Oh, yeah.
Fight Club, wasn't it, that bit?
That's in the book as well.
Is it?
Oh. Which is really weird. Like, the film is almost a literal translation from the book. There's like one subplot on a beach that's kind of not in it. But like,
because everyone always said that to me when I was a projectionist. They're like, oh, did you cut it splicing a penis, you know, like in Fight Club? I was like, where are we going to get that 35mm, you know, shot of some bloke's dick?
Oh, I can get you one if you want.
You know,
I like the idea of a 35mm penis.
What's funny about that?
Nothing there.
But it was that, yeah. So once I was made redundant, I had time to kill and thought, well, let's have a stab at this YouTube. And it was like, at the time, when everyone reviewing movies were either just bashing them, or I think that was it, really. I mean, there wasn't that many YouTubers sort of celebrating the films they grew up watching.
Sure.
So I thought, well, let's take perspective of have something educational with a critique.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of evolved over that. So, it's been...
So what, you bought a camera?
No, I never on camera when I do the reviews.
Of course not.
Yeah, no. So you're just editing.
I've just seen you do more recent reviews when you're on camera.
I had done stuff on camera, but for the retrospectives, that stuff that kind of the channel's built on, it's just all like edited stuff with footage from films, documentaries, where I can find the stuff.
So the format of that is you do sort of an edited highlights of the film.
Like a trailer. I do like a trailer at the beginning, then it's sort of like a introduction about its history, production, cast, and to the story, then go into visual effects, the music in the film, the score. Because most people, when they often critique movies, they never discuss the score itself.
The elements that make the film.
Yeah, because if you took away the score from Star Wars, it's not going to work. The whole film falls flat. So, you know, not commenting on the quality of that and its importance, I thought was always valid, I think, when critiquing a film. Especially one that has something like a Alan Silvestri or James Horner or John Williams score attached to it. You've got to talk about it.
And you can talk about it in the context of their body of work, not just in terms of the film and where that played. You know, oh, this film had a good soundtrack. It's just that, what did this score sound like compared to the rest of their films?
Yeah, exactly. And if I discussed a movie such as Batman from 1989, I'd talk about like the video games that came out, because that was an interesting aspect. Because, you know, I played video games as a kid and I still play them now and again.
Actually, I remember the Batman video game.
Yeah, the one for the, I think,
Amiga.
Commodore Amiga.
Yeah.
That was a big deal at the time.
Oh, yeah, you shoot your thing out and go around corners in your Batmobile.
Yeah.
You've got to shoot your wire out. And you've got another bit where you've got to put all your different chemicals together.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't play computer games. I remember the Ghostbusters game on the Spectrum.
So do I.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was the shittest game. It took fucking ages to upload.
And weren't you going around a map as well?
It was going around a map, and, it took ages. I had a Spectrum in, like, 1983. which also had the Hunchback of Notre Dame on it.
Oh, yes, I remember that game.
Which was a great game. The cover artwork was fantastic.
I think I found that weird about scores recently. I watched Howard the Duck the other week.
Yeah, we never got to the end of that.
Thomas Dolby does so the soundtrack bad. For it, does the song in it, and the main theme, they ask Thomas Dolby to do it, and he's like, he's a one-hit wonder, but he obviously is massive in America for like 6 months. Yeah. So they get him to do all the music for it, apart from the main theme, and they go, and he's like, nah, I'm too busy to do the main theme. It's like, you've done everything else. And so they call up John Barry and go, will you do it? And John Barry goes, yeah. So John Barry does just the main theme, but all the other music is Thomas Dolby. And you think, that must be a bizarre phone call.
Army of Darkness. Army of Darkness, yeah, because Danny Elfman did the main theme.
He did the main theme, then Joseph LaDuca did the score.
But it feels like...
But the weird thing about that is that it feels so intertwined. I mean, it's not like you go, well, that's Danny... I mean, it does all sound like Danny Elfman.
You can't, tell difference. No. That's good orchestrations and good composers sort of copying each other.
See, it must have been a real kick in the dick for John Barry, to do Howard the Duck after everyone, like Thomas Dolby has basically turned it down, and they go, John Barry? And he's like, yeah, I'll do it.
I don't see it like that. I see it like John Barry coming in and saving the day.
I guess this
fucking punk, he turned up, he did 90% of the work, we just need a
theme. I like to think they've got like a roll of money going and he's got me all right. I mean, that's the only way you can sort of justify it.
No. I'm sure he was just, well, it was George Lucas, wasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
It would have been, but then if it's George Lucas, why wasn't it John Williams?
Mm.
Well, of the list of people that turned it down.
That's the funny thing, isn't it? Because George Lucas always gets blamed for that movie. He just produced it, he didn't direct it.
But he had a passion for it.
Yeah.
He's the one that wanted to put with the duck on. I mean, George Lucas doesn't get enough credit for The Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi either. People begrudgingly give George Lucas credit for all of his greatest achievements. Captain EO. Wonderful, wonderful short film.
I never saw that ride. I mean, you've been to Disney,
yeah,
haven't you?
It was good. It was good. It was like a really long thriller video.
It was really impressive. I mean, that 3D that they had at Disney was incredible.
Absolutely crazy, the making of that. I mean, it's George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, Michael Jackson. And like, you go, fucking hell. Angelica Houston's in it. It's just insane how much money they put into that.
I've seen like there's like really low res copy of it on YouTube, like the 2D version. So I've not seen.
You'll probably never be able to see it again now that the documentaries have come out. I mean, you just won't be able to. I've got a framed Captain EO poster at home that I think it's actually in storage. I looked at it and I went, no, I'm not going to put that up. The documentary's come out in the space of me moving house. I'm just like,
everyone's
probably
taking down their Moonwalker posters.
It's not ironic anymore. It's now like, no, he... Mm.
We've only spoken about your documentary when we've been off air, when the music's been playing. So we should really talk about...
You've made this documentary called Last... go on. I was trying to
you
be...
made Last Action Hero, didn't you?
I made Last Action Hero. Well,
in Search of the Last Action Hero. In Search of the Last Action Hero. Bit of a mouthful, but yes.
No, it's great. It's great. In Search of the Last Action Heroes. I can say it.
Yeah, basically about the action genre from the 80s up until the 90s, and it's when it all kind of sort of changed, come... The new actors stepped in, like Keanu Reeves and Nick Cage and things like that.
We were talking about this just before you came on in the first half. The sort of like the Planet Hollywood spike in Sylvester Stallone's career in the early 90s. So he'd done Rocky V, Stop and My Mum Will Shoot, Oscar. And then it was just like... The way that Cliffhanger came back and it actually felt like, oh, this is a huge comeback for him.
Yeah, two big hits, Cliffhanger and Demolition Man. And then he followed it with Judge Dredd.
Which I like. I like Judge Dredd.
I like the look of it. But Judge Dredd never removes his helmet.
I don't, yeah. Well, if that's the thing. I never read the comics. So I can watch it. And we've already discussed this on this episode. But like, I like loads of things about it. And if you called it something other than Judge Dredd, it would be a better film, I think. Mm. But I enjoy loads of stuff about it. I think, what happened to Danny Cannon?
Went to TV. did...
he does one of Law and Order, doesn't he? Yes, one of them. I think he produces it, even.
Yeah, very successful.
Right. You know, so. And he also did one of the... I Know What You Did Last Summer, didn't he? I think he did
the second one.
Yeah. I still know what you did last summer. Yeah. Anyway, so your documentary... Go on, tell us about it.
So, yeah, we crowdfunded it on Kickstarter. Was pretty successful. Then we went and got shot... So we went and shot the documentary in LA in October. So interviewing, like, Ronnie Cox, Janet Goldstein, Bill Duke... Eric Roberts, Vernon Wells from Mad Max, Brad Fidel recently. I interviewed him a couple months ago. Obviously, composer of Terminator 1 and 2 and True Lies. And coming up soon, we're going to be last minute interview with Paul Verhoeven.
Ah, wow.
So, yeah, maybe we got over like about 30 people. The more, see, there's always a thing with documentaries when you're, you know, shooting interviews, if you go beyond a certain number, it just becomes a nightmare to edit. And you end up with too many talking heads. So, you know, some people say, oh, you should get Stallone and Schwarzenegger. We had tried at the time, but some of these people come with...
That's like, Frank Stallone and Ian Schwarzenegger.
But some come with really difficult agents.
Of course, yeah.
Like force films.
But to be honest, you know? I've seen them talk about their work. Mm. And, you know, one of my favourite things about that He-Man documentary that came out was Dolph Lundgren popping up and talking about how much he loved making.
No, it was Frank Mangello, wasn't it?
Dolph Lundgren was in the He-Man documentary, the one on Netflix.
The Power of Grayskull one.
But Frank Mangello was the one that actually enjoyed making it.
Oh, he loved it.
Yeah. He had a great
That's
time.
One of his favourite roles.
That's one of my favourite film facts. Yeah. It's just how much he loved doing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's like Raul Julia, who was M. Bison in Street Fighter. He did it because his kids loved the video game. But then he sadly died.
Yeah, but it was a worthy send-off.
So it'll be remembered for.
I remember in the mid-90s in Empire magazine, they're doing one of those Review of the Summer or Review of the Year.
Yeah.
And in that, they were talking about the first Mission Impossible... Was it called Hard Rain?
Yes. Hard Rain, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Was that Keanu Reeves or Christian Slater?
It's Christian Slater, Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, yeah. And what was the Keanu Reeves one at the same time?
Chain Reaction.
Yeah. And they were the three films they were talking about. And
with Morgan Freeman again?
Yes.
Keanu Reeves, Morgan Freeman, and Rachel Weisz.
I think they were all... So it must have been 96, I guess. And they're all talking about this thing. And it was all about how they've basically made these action movies with these guys who aren't action people. And that was it. And they were talking about, like, can these guys pull it off? And you think, since then, they're the people that do action movies.
Yeah.
They're pre-existing actors who might be in completely other types of movies, and then the action genre just embraces them and going... And in hindsight, I always think of that thing of... That was seen as such a weird thing at the time. Mm. That you've made these action movies with Cruise...
Nicolas Cage going from Kiss of Death and stuff like that to doing The Rock was...
Yeah.
What did he do before The Rock? Or maybe Snake Eyes always got lumped in with all of that.
Mm. That's a bit later. I think that was a Joel Schumacher movie.
Snake Eyes was De Palma.
Brian De Palma. Is it De Palma?
Yeah. Wow.
What was the 8mm was Schumacher.
Yes.
But they all got kind of like lumped in together and... That's a Brian De Palma thriller, and that's a Joel Schumacher thriller. They're not the same as The Rock. Nicolas Cage doing The Rock was fucking crazy, and then Con Air.
Mm.
Whew, what a movie!
But that's it. They've completely been replaced, haven't they?
The narrative is it kind of starts with a lot of the actors and directors and writers we've interviewed, sort of discussing what do they watch growing up. Mm. Mostly westerns. Goes into James Bond. Then you go to sort of 70s gritty sort of crime thrillers with sort of kind of anti-heroes. Then you've got a bit of Bruce Lee, blaxploitation. And then bang, the 80s, you've got this new wave of action. Okay, so question for you, chaps. What do you think, what was the one movie of the 80s that's really kick-started that action genre with the sort of muscle-bound hero, sort of, you know...
Commando? Kids?
First Blood?
82, First Blood, yeah. Because most, when we sort of quiz... You know, the people throughout the documentary. What was that one movie that really kickstarted it? And most probably said it was First Blood, followed by Mad Max 2. Because Mad Max 2 was it
First Blood?
That's 82. Yeah. So Mad Max 2.
Did I get it right?
You got it right. Yeah.
But I would say that was retrospectively. Because First Blood is more of a Vietnam drama with action elements. Yeah, and then when you get to something like Terminator, which is like...
So 85 is where it really kind of 80s action really just went crazy. Because you had First Blood Part 2.
Yeah, First Blood Part 2 is for sure.
And Commando, which was this you had the hero who was essentially a Superman who would just take down his bad guys.
Commando?
Yeah.
It's an incredible film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just 88 minutes of killing people and saying something funny afterwards. And it's just like, it's got Vernon Wells in it, right?
Yeah.
What was it like meeting Bill Duke?
So my producer, well, co-writer, Tymon Singh, he had done the LA interviews. And, I mean, watching the sort of Bill Duke footage, I mean, he's... Most people talk to him about his Predator. That's all everyone wants talked about.
Not Sister Act 2, Beck and the Habit.
No. He was at the end of the interview, it was quite strange, because Ty says to him, oh, you know, they're remaking Sister Act. And he's like, what? And it cuts. I was like, no! I want to see that reaction.
Yeah.
But, making Predator, like, one of the stories he had was, like, you think Arnold was the strongest guy on set, but it was his trainer, right. Sven Olsen. He's like, he pops up in Conan the Barbarian. He's in The Running Man.
Right.
Is this Arnold's friend? He just picks up Arnold by his elbows and lifts him up like that. That's how strong he was. Crazy.
So is this now fully funded? Are you still looking
for... Yeah. It's fully funded. Okay. Fully funded, yeah. So we...
You're just finishing it off.
Yeah, I've got it. Basically, we had a 3-hour cut, which we watched about 2 weeks ago, and I've got to get it down to 2 hours. I've got to cut out an hour, which is tough.
So where are you releasing it?
It should be available end of July, but it depends, because it's got to go through the checks, legal checks.
And are you going to release extras?
Yes. So yeah, all those little things like delete scenes. Everything I'm cutting out...
This is going to be incredible. It's going to be really incredible. Yeah. I'm really excited about it. I love your web series, your YouTube channel. I always watch it when I'm cooking. I think it's brilliant. I love it. I think it's great. It was really good to have you on.
Thank you, Nick.
We've got to play a game with you now.
Oh, we do.
That was the wrong button.
Was it the wrong one? This is better or worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinion,
right,
beginning with... Angela Bassett. Is Leah Thompson better or worse than Angela Bassett?
Better.
Oh, high cards.
Worse, but she's a high card.
She is worse, but
it's a high card.
High cards, I agree.
Leah Thompson there. So Emma Thompson, better or worse than Leah Thompson?
Better.
Better, yeah, she's better. Gwyneth Paltrow, better or worse than Emma Thompson?
Who's this?
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Gwyneth Paltrow. Better or worse than Emma Thompson? Oh, worse. Worse.
John Lithgow. Better or worse than Gwyneth Paltrow?
Better.
A fucking New York mile. Fucking.
Alec Guinness. Better or worse than John Lithgow?
Oh, that is tough.
I say
worse because Lithgow is funny. Really funny.
Alec Guinness is funny. He's funny.
I would say John Lithgow is better.
Alec Guinness is better.
Oh, wow. Of course she said that.
Jake Gyllenhaal, better or worse than Alec Guinness?
Worse. Without even thinking.
Yeah, go on, yeah.
He's worse.
That's harsh, though. I like him.
Maggie Gyllenhaal, better or worse than Jake Gyllenhaal?
Worse.
She is worse, but I think she's quite a high card. Peter Sellers, better or worse than Maggie Gyllenhaal?
Better?
Better.
Tim Robbins, better or worse than Peter Sellers?
Better. Oh, worse!
Oh, no, he's worse, yeah.
He was in Hudsucker Proxy. What? I mean, he was in The Sure Thing. He was in Howard the Duck. Worse. Answered my own question there.
I think worse.
Worse, yeah, worse. That's it. Seven.
All right, well, you're not
quite
good.
Not quite as good as
Sean Harries, Ingrid Oliver, John Niven with 10, Daniel Cook, Daniel Lawrence, Taylor, Michael Legg, Solomon Gray, Rebecca Staten with 9, Claudia Blakely, Jordan Brooks, Suze Kempner, Evelyn Mott, Paul F. Tenner, Rebecca Shorts, Mark Smith, and Carl Theobald with 8. But you are as good as Hayley Campbell, Brett Goldstein, Tom Goodman Hill, Charlie Higson, Matthew Holness, Jim Hoskin, Laura Lex, Mark Smith, Esther Smith, Ian Smith, Elliot Bellinkiller, Josh Whitaker, and Sean McLaughlin with 7. And you're better than Drunk History, Self and Crime, Taylor Glenn, Hannah George, Mike Hyatt, and Colin Holt, Andy Kindler, Merritt Larwood, Lucy Porter, John Robbins, Richard Sandling, Mark Simmons, David Trent with 6. Yasmin Ackman, Rob Deering, Tom Meaton, Joey Page, Glenn Will with 5. Jack Barry, Bunny Glore, Taylor Glenn, and Katie Wilkins with 4. And controversially, Sam Ashurst with nothing. So
we need a recount on that, probably.
Need a recount on that last one because I don't think it's possible to score none, but it's possible, but it'd be unheard of. Great. What a nice one. Thank you for coming in. And I will see you online.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, chaps.
No,
it's
you're
been
very
a blast.
Welcome. Yeah, and I can't wait for your documentary. It's going to be brilliant. And congratulations on meeting all them fucking legends.
Thank you.
Mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be. When I grew up and fell in love, I asked my sweetheart what lies ahead. Will we have rainbows day after day? Here's what my sweetheart said. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be. Now I have children of my own. They ask their mother, what will I be? Will I be handsome? Will I be...
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.